Nasta Prayeshwabhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. So this morning we're going to read from the 10th canto, chapter 14, about Lord Brahma's prayer about jnana, kanda, the path of knowledge. But before we do, I'd like to go back and review the context in which this verse comes. This is a poignant section of Srimad Bhagavatam for Srila Prabhupada's disciples and followers, because Srila Prabhupada began translating Srimad Bhagavatam in 1961, thereabouts, and continued right up until he left this world November 14th of 1977. Actually, the day before, he was doing the purports for the 13th chapter of the 10th canto. So he went from the first canto all the way through the 13th chapter of the 10th canto. The 10th canto is, of course, Krishna's pastimes, the sunam bonam, the smiling face of the whole work. And knowing that he may not be able to finish his ornate verse-by-verse translations and commentary, he published the Krishna book, which was a summary study of all 90 chapters of the 10th canto, in advance of, even before he completed the second canto. So the remaining chapters of the 10th canto were translated and commented upon by his disciples, headed by Hridayananda Maharaj and Gopi Puranadana Prabhu. So they completed the 10th canto, and then the 11th and 12th cantos. And thus the entire work was complete. Yes? Yes. Yes, it's a summary study, which means he presents the translations in a context with by which a lay reader or a new reader could appreciate or understand them. That's correct. It's like purports woven in, basically. Mm-hmm. All right, so this section, then, this chapter begins the very first purports that were published in Srimad Bhagavatam that were not written by Srila Prabhupada. And you'll see the different flavor of the commentary when we get to that in a moment. But first I'd like to put this all in context. What is this pastime, the Brahma Vimohana Leela? So the early chapters of the 10th canto deal with Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan as a young child. By the time he's 5-6 years old, he is already employed along with his peers and taking care of the calves in this simple rural village, Vrindavan, in which he lives. So he and the boys go out every morning with all the calves, and their responsibility is to see that they are fed and watered, that they graze and come back in the afternoon. So it's a combination of vocational training as well as recreation and education for the boys. This is how they spend their days, because that is their vocation, to learn how to take care of cows. So they start with the calves. And they of course, are given this responsibility, and they take it very seriously. At the same time, they have a great deal of fun every day when they're going out. So after Kamsa attempted to kill Krishna by killing all of the babies who had been born within the last 10 days, he kept hearing about this boy in Vrindavan. So he would send his agents to try to kill Krishna, some of his associates, Putana and others. So one of them was Agha. This gigantic, actually, these were mystic yogis who would take these various forms in order to try to kill Krishna. So in the case of Agha, he assumed the form of a gigantic serpent, 8 miles long. And the boys saw this serpent and marched right in because they felt, oh, Krishna has killed all these other demons. Even if this, they weren't sure if it was a big tunnel or what. But they said, even if it's a danger to us, Krishna will save us. So So Krishna saw this scene of all of his friends walking into the mouth of the serpent. And he marveled at his material energy. So after the boys went in, Krishna went in after them, killed Agha, rescued the boys, and then they all marched away. So this huge corpse of the snake was left there. And Shukadeva Goswami mentions that the residents of Vrindavan came upon the corpse of the snake about a year later. And Shukadeva Goswami says, "What? A year? How come it took them a year to find out about it? Didn't the boys tell them when they got home?" So then he proceeds to explain, well, actually there was a year's gap, and here's what happened. After the boys left Agha, they all went to have their lunch. And Lord Brahma, who is, of course, the original resident and engineer of the universe, was watching all of this and very perplexed. How is Krishna killing these big demons and doing all these incredible things? How is this little boy doing that? So he decided to test Krishna to see how powerful he really was. This is a frequent theme in the 10th canto, that the Lord is tested by various personalities. So Lord Brahma is testing him. And watching after the death of Agha, he sees that Krishna and all the boys go over and sit down and break out their lunch bags and start having their lunch. So as they're doing this, the calves have wandered away somewhere in search of new grass. So that when the boys notice it, they're all about to stand up and run and get the calves. And Krishna says, no, don't worry. You stay here. Enjoy your lunch. I'll go find the calves. So Krishna goes away from the group. So Lord Brahma, seeing this, decides this would be a good opportunity to test Krishna. So he puts all the boys to sleep by mystic slumber and gathers them all up and takes them to a hiding place in a cave nearby. So when Krishna returns, they're all gone. All of his friends are gone. And Brahma is watching. Well, now what's he going to do? And Krishna, of course, knows exactly what's going on. And he wants to help Lord Brahma learn a lesson. And so he instantly manifests himself as all the cows and boys. Lord Brahma had also taken the calves, by the way. Yes, he'd taken the calves, so that's why they were missing. So all the calves and the boys were all gone. Krishna immediately manifests himself through his Vishnu expansions in the exact same form of each of the boys and calves. They were so precise that all of their clothing was the same, all of their characteristics were the same, and even the mothers of the boys and the calves couldn't tell the difference. In fact, after they got home that evening, and when all the boys went home, their mothers were suddenly far more enthusiastic to feed their boys and bathe their boys and hug their boys than they'd ever been before. And the cows, when their calves came in the barn, they started licking them like from head to toe. Like they couldn't show enough affection. So all of this was going on for a year. So it so happened this day that Agha was killed and the boys were stolen. That was Lord Balaram's birthday. So his mother had kept him home for the day and he wasn't there. So later that year, Balaram noticed a very interesting phenomenon on Govardhan Hill. All the older cows were up on the hill, and the men, who of course were the examples for their young sons, were tending the older cows. And all of a sudden, the cows, seeing the calves who were with the boys, started charging down the hill, out of control. Then these were calves that were weaned already. These were not the very, very small calves who were still at the village. So the coward men were very upset. "Come back, come back." They couldn't control the herd as they started running after the cows. And the cows dashed down the hill. So they had the humps on their back, you know, like the Brahma cows do. And these humps were sliding back and forth. And they were galloping like two legs at a time, two legs front, two legs back, really fast, charging down. And they rushed up to the calves that were in Krishna's care and started licking them and nursing them and just being so affectionate to them. Then the men came charging, huffing and puffing. But instead of being angry at the cows, when they saw their sons They forgot all about the cows and started embracing their sons and sniffing their heads. And Balaram saw all this and said, what is going on? This is very unusual. It must be something to do with Krishna, because only Krishna's tricks work on me. So he asked Krishna about it, and Krishna disclosed the whole thing. So the next day, which again was Balaram's birthday, 1 year later, Krishna was walking with all the cows and calves and boys, and they all suddenly manifested their Vishnu form. He knew that Lord Brahma was watching, trying to figure out how this was going on. And then all the boys and calves transformed into Vishnus with their four arms and their long black hair and their Kaustubha gems around their chest, surrounded by swarms of bees, intoxicated by the fragrance of their garland, and surrounded also by loving devotees performing kirtan. This whole procession all of a sudden is there following Krishna. And Lord Brahma was completely astonished. Now, he had just taken the boys and put them in the cave and come back to see what Krishna was going to do. Because in Lord Brahma's time, that one moment that took, or a few seconds that it took for him to do that, was a year of our time. So for him, he had just taken the boys, put them away, and then come back to see what Krishna was going to do. And there are all these Vishnu forms following Krishna, transforming from exact duplicates of the boys to these Vishnus. In this way, Krishna was having great fun with Lord Brahma. And having seen all this, Lord Brahma was very humbled. He was very astonished. So he came down to earth and put his head on the ground. Now, this is something the gods don't do. You know, they look at earth like this low-class planet. Prabhupada said, in Kali Yuga, the gods do not even come to earth to pass urine. But in previous ages, they would come and attend sacrifices and take their share of the sacrifices. So it was a common thing, like these ancient aliens. There was a regular interaction between gods, the demigods, and humanity, but not in Kali Yuga. So Lord Brahma came and not only came to earth, but put his head down on the earth, bowing down before Krishna, or his four heads. So it's very nicely described there that when he stood up, he was very bewildered, but he saw this beautiful land of Vrindavan with all of its pastoral settings, the hills, the trees, the cows, and the river Jamuna, just a gorgeous natural scene. It also describes a similar experience he had when he was first meditating at the beginning of the universe and heard these syllables, tapa, so he was meditating, and then all of a sudden found himself in Goloka Vrindavan, the abode of the Lord. And again, he saw all of these beautiful pastoral scenes that are described in the Brahma Samhita. Chintamani, Prakara, Sadma, Shukapa, Vriksha, Laksha, Vriteshu, Surabhi, Rabi, Pali, Yamintam. The touchstone buildings and the cows and everything is so beautiful. So Lord Brahma has this beautiful vision, and he sees Krishna standing there, this little boy, carrying part of his lunch, a little lump of rice and yogurt and fruit mixed together in his hand. And he just sees how he's completely shown all these incredible powers, and he's very humbled. So then he offers his respects, and then he begins offering prayers. That's the very last verse Srila Prabhupada commented on before he left this world. And he mentioned that these prayers spoken by Lord Brahma were simply spontaneous right off the top of his head. And that is where we take up here in chapter 14. Some of these verses are wonderfully well-known and famous verses from the Bhagavatam, frequently quoted. So we're going to read the translations of the first eight verses and then focus on verse 4. So do we have microphones up? We'd like to read the translation for verse 1. Okay. Menka, please go ahead. Okay, it's dead. Okay, why don't you start, gentlemen? Go ahead.
O son of king of the cowherds, your transcendental body is dark blue like a new cloud. Your garment is brilliant like lightning, and the beauty of your face is enhanced by your gunja earrings and the peacock feather on your head.
Does anyone know what is gunja? What's that? Berries. Oh, I see. So just some natural. Very interesting. Okay. Ah. You thought it was shells? Shells. Ah. Okay. Read on, please.
Wearing garlands of various forest flowers and leaves and equipped with a herding stick, a buffalo horn, and a flute, you stand beautifully with a morsel of food in your hand.
This is what he's saying.
My dear Lord, neither I nor anyone else can estimate the potency of this transcendental body of yours, which has shown such mercy to me and which appears just to fulfill the desires of your pure devotees. Although my mind is completely withdrawn from material matters and affairs, rather, I cannot understand your personal form. How then could I possibly understand the happiness you experience within yourself?
Those who, even while remaining situated in their established social positions, throw away the process of speculative knowledge, and with their body, words, and mind offer all respects to descriptions of your personality and activities, dedicating their lives to these narrations, which are vibrated by you personally and by your pure devotees, certainly conquer your lordship, although you are otherwise unconquerable by anyone within the three worlds.
My dear Lord, devotional service unto you is the best path for self-realization. If someone gives up that path and engages in the cultivation of speculative knowledge, he will simply undergo a troublesome process and will not achieve his desired result. As a person who beats an empty husk of wheat cannot get grain, one who simply speculates cannot achieve self-realization. His only gain is trouble.
O Almighty Lord, in the past, many yogis in this world achieved the platform of devotional service by offering all their endeavors unto you and faithfully carrying out their prescribed duties. Through such devotional service, perfected by the processes of hearing and chanting about you, they came to understand you, O Infallible One, and could easily surrender to you and achieve your supreme abode.
Non-devotees, however, cannot realize you in your full personal feature. Nevertheless, it may be possible for them to realize your expansion as the impersonal supreme by cultivating direct perception of the self within the heart. But they can do this only by purifying their mind and senses of all conceptions of material distinctions and all attachment to material sense objects. Only in this way will your impersonal feature manifest itself to them.
In time, learned philosophers or scientists might be able to count all the atoms of the earth, the particles of snow, or perhaps even the shining molecules radiating from the sun, the stars, and other luminaries. But among these learned men, who could possibly count the unlimited transcendental qualities possessed by you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has descended onto the surface of the earth for the benefit of all living beings?
And then this last verse, which is a real... Your Prabhupada say this should be the motto of all devotees.
My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all while patiently suffering the reactions of past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim.
Okay, now hold that for just a minute. So the theme of these first verses spoken by Lord Brahma is, I mean, there are various themes. One of them is about knowledge, which is today's topic. But in the previous verses, he's saying that how people get liberation in this way and that way by trying to understand this or doing the mystical yoga process. But for one who simply awaits for your... This is such a devotional statement, right? Just, okay, I'm going to patiently suffer my karma, all the sufferings I'm going through, expecting and awaiting the Lord's mercy all the while, and continuing to offer him respects within my heart, in spite of the fact that I'm suffering. That person becomes eligible for liberation, just as the son or daughter of a wealthy family is eligible to inherit their wealth of their parents. You don't have to do anything, just stay alive. So basically, we just stay alive in Krishna consciousness, going through the sufferings of material life, you become eligible for liberation. It's just your right. It is your rightful claim. See, so he's contrasting the difficult process of trying to understand God through knowledge with this automatic process of just continuing to serve Krishna in spite of difficulties. Okay? These are the first of about 30 prayers, the first 8 that we read. This one in particular is a very famous and frequently quoted verse. So, any comments on this? Anything up to this point? Let's go back to verse 4. This is our topic for the day. Is that verse 4? That's verse 4? Okay. Shreya Shritim Bhakti Mudasyate Vibho.
Shreya Shritim Bhakti Mudasyate Vibho.
Vishyanti Yekai Vala Bodha Labdhyate.
Vishyanti Yekai Vala
Bodha Labdhyate. Tesham Asau Kleshala Eva Shishyate. Nanyadyata stula tusha bhaghatinam.
Nanyadyata stula
tusha bhaghatinam. Shreya shritim bhaktim udasyate vibho.
Shreya shritim bhaktim udasyate vibho.
Vishyanti ye kevala bodha labdhaye.
Vishyanti ye kevala bodha labdhaye.
Tesham asau kleshala eva shishyate. Nanyadyata stula tusha bhaghatinam.
Nanyadyata
stula tusha bhaghatinam. Anyone like to chant?
Shreya
shritim bhaktim adasyate vibho. Kushyanti ye kevala bodha labdhaye. Tesham asau kleshala eva shishyate. Tanyad yata stula tusha vaghatinam. Shreya shritim bhaktim udasyate vibho. Klishyanti ye kevala bodha labdaye. Tesham asate chala eva shishyate. Nanyadita stula tusha bhaghatinam. Synonyms, please. Let's read together. Shreya of supreme benefit, shrittim, the path, bhaktim, devotional service, udasya, rejecting, te, they, vibho, O Almighty Lord, Klishyanti, struggle, ye, who, kevala, exclusive, bodha, of knowledge, labdhaye, for the achievement, tesham, for them, asau, klishala, botheration, eva, merely, shishyate, remains, nothing, anya, other, yata, just as, stula, tusha, empty husks, avakatinam, for those who are beating. Translation. Let's again read together. My dear Lord, devotional service unto you is the best path for self-realization. If someone gives up that path and engages in the cultivation of speculative knowledge, he will simply undergo a troublesome process and will not achieve its desired result. As a person who beats an empty husk of wheat cannot get grain, one who simply speculates cannot achieve self-realization. His only gain is trouble. Purport. Loving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the natural and eternal function of every living entity. If a person renounces his own constitutional function and instead laboriously seeks so-called enlightenment through impersonal, speculative knowledge, his result is simply the trouble and bother that comes from following an artificial process. A fool may beat an empty husk, not knowing that the grain has already been removed. Similarly, foolish is the person who throws his mind again and again into the pursuit of knowledge without surrendering to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For it is the Supreme Personality of Godhead who is the very substance and goal of knowledge, just as grain is the substance and goal of the entire agricultural effort. Vedic knowledge, or indeed material science without the Personality of Godhead, is exactly like an empty and useless husk of wheat. You see the different flavor in the purport, can you tell? from Prabhupada's disciples to Prabhupada, kind of more contemporary language, a little sharper, but all based on Prabhupada's teachings. One may argue that by practicing yoga or cultivating impersonal knowledge, one can acquire prestige, wealth, mystic powers, or even impersonal liberation. So this is, before we go on, cultivating impersonal knowledge. This is really akin to any kind of educational experience. It can bring one prestige and wealth, or if it's in the spiritual realm, it can bring impersonal liberation. But all of this, these so-called gains are actually useless because they do not situate the living being in his constitutional position of loving service to the Supreme Lord. This sounds like a very dogmatic statement, but it's actually very true. It's a very simple thing. If we don't learn how to love God, what is the use of all of our education? Okay? What is the use of our knowledge? So in that regard, I like to have a spontaneous theatrical performance. All right, our first rehearsal begins right now. Okay, you stand right there. Okay, so there was once a scholar who was visiting India, and he was traveling up the Ganges being rowed by a local boatman. And as he was riding, he said, "My dear boatman, look at these sedimentary formations on the side of the river. Have you ever studied geology?" 25% of your life is wasted. "Oh, look, there's a dolphin jumping in the fresh water. How interesting he'd be so far upriver. My dear boatman, have you ever studied marine biology?" 50% of your life is wasted. "Oh, my dear boatman, look at those clouds. Those appear to be monsoon clouds blowing in our direction. Have you ever studied meteorology?" No. 75% of your life is wasted. "Those clouds are very close. Oh, it's raining. Oh, look, the boat is filling up with water. What are we going to do?" "No." Very dramatic. So, the point is that we may know many things and study many things, but if our motive is impure, in other words, if our motive is to gain prestige or wealth or recognition or some other self-centered benefit, then we haven't understood the most basic knowledge, that we are servants of God. Before God, we are very insignificant and very tiny, and we don't know how to humble ourselves before Him. See, lacking that one simple piece of knowledge, anything else we may learn is just, it's not only useless, it is a burden, because it fills us up with pride. In the second canto, Shukadeva Goswami compares it to a turban wrapped around one's head. If one falls in the water with this heavy bejeweled turban, it just causes one to sink to the bottom. So trying to swim through the ocean of material existence with this heavy turban on the head is a big obstacle. So this is why this statement, although very strongly worded, actually is not just dogmatic. "Therefore, such results, being superfluous to the living being's essential nature, are impermanent. As stated in the Nrisimha Purana, Patreshu, Pushpeshu, Paleshu, Toishu, akrita labyeshu vadaiva satsu bhaktya sa labhe purushe purane mukhya kim artam kriyate prayatnaha. Since the primeval personality of Godhead is easily attained by offering him such things as leaves, water, leaves, flowers, fruits, and water, which are all found without difficulty, why does one need to endeavor for liberation separately? Does this remind anyone of a verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Who can quote that verse? Patram pushpam palam toyam. No. Please stay on the verse you were. Please go back to the verse where you just left. Yes, just stay there. Okay. You're right. Patram pushpam palam toyam. Leaves, flowers, fruits, and water. Just consider the sequence there. It's actually very interesting. Leaves come in which season? In the spring. Right. They fall off in the fall. But they appear in the spring. And then flowers in the summer. And then fruits in the fall. And in the winter, nothing. But you can always get water. So the point is, any season, one can find some simple thing to offer to Krishna and thus achieve the same results that philosophers, that speculators try so hard to achieve through a mental process. So, why, therefore, this similar verse from the Nrsimha Purana says, why does one need to try separately to become liberated? Let's talk for a moment. What does this liberation mean? You don't go to college classes and hear, okay, class, we're here today to learn how to be liberated. You know, right? It's not on the curriculum. But at the same time, everybody is looking to get relief from their problems. We're thinking that we get an education, and then we can get a nice job, and then we'll have a nice salary, and we can have a nice family. Then I'll be happy. See, presently, I'm missing something. Okay. So everyone is feeling something lacking in their lives, some deficiency. And that's what we're talking about when we say liberation. I want to be free of my problems. Okay. I want to be free of my anxieties. So even though that's not the specific topic, the direct topic, indirectly it is understood that the reason we study anything, we learn anything, is to give us liberation. It is to give us freedom from our problems and anxieties, right? Does anyone study something just to increase their problems? Is that true, Vaishnava? Even these esoteric sciences, I mean, these very deep sciences, like I was thinking this one, listening to Druta Karma Prabhu's presentation. What is the purpose of studying when humanity originated? You know, or what is the purpose of studying quarks or quasars or black holes or all of these theoretical existences that are assumed to be there in physics? Isn't the purpose that through this pursuit of knowledge, in the end, we're going to figure out all of our problems? We're going to understand our place in the universe. We're going to have perspective on our history and our existence. And this knowledge will help us get rid of our problems. Isn't that the assumption? So when we talk about liberation, it's look at it in a very, very broad sense. It's happiness. It's freedom. It's a solution to our problems. Okay? Anyone like to read the last paragraph?
Although the process of devotional service to Lord Krishna is very simple, it is extremely difficult for stubborn conditioned souls to completely humble themselves before the Supreme Personality of Godhead and absorb themselves 24 hours a day in His loving service. The mood of loving service is anathema.
Anathema, yeah, like the total opposite, like something intolerable.
To belligerent conditioned souls determined to defy God and enjoy. When such stubborn conditioned souls attempt to bypass surrendering to God through proud attempts at philosophical speculation, austerity, and yoga,
They are turned back to the material platform by the powerful laws of God and violently merged into the heaving ocean of insignificance called the material world.
Dramatic. So again, the verse is stating that trying to find liberation, trying to find happiness, trying to find God through knowledge is like beating a husk of grain that has already surrendered its rice. It's just, it's already empty. It's not, it's a waste of time. There were some scholars in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes that illustrate this point nicely. One of them was this Keshava Kashmiri, the traveling pandit, Digvijay, who is going and defeating other scholars through logic and debate. So this was the pastime in medieval India before video games were invented. That people would sit and joust philosophically. Yeah, somebody would make a point, and someone would make a counterpoint, and whoever came out on top was considered the winner of the debate and a great scholar. So this is this pandit was particularly good and traveled throughout India, attempting to defeat everyone and pretty much succeeding. But when he came to Navadvip and encountered this young Nimai pandit, he showed his erudition by spontaneously composing 100 verses in praise of the Ganges. So Lord Chaitanya just sat and listened as these verses just flowed out from the scholar's mouth, like just like air through the sky, just pouring out of his mouth. So Lord Chaitanya listened, and then he said, in essence, "Oh, that was very nice, but there, you made a mistake in verse 64. You referred to Lord Shiva as the... What was it? You referred to the wife of Lord Shiva twice. You basically were redundant in this expression that you used." And the scholar was shocked that this young man could not only hear and understand and remember everything he'd said, but also find the faults in it. And he proceeded to find some more faults. He said, "These are the good points about the poem, these were the bad points about the poem." And so Keshava Kashmiri was then humbled. So the point is that God has to humble. If we are unable to humble ourselves before God, then God will, if he's kind to us, he will help us become humble. And if we resist his efforts, eventually he'll win when we are humbled and bow down to death. See, when Srila Prabhupada was asked, "Why are they, all your disciples, why are they bowing down?" He said, "They are voluntarily submitting themselves. And if you choose not to, that's fine. You will involuntarily submit yourself to God when you die." So this is so much of Krishna consciousness is this: accepting in advance austerities that we're going to have to accept anyway. I mean, isn't that something responsible, mature, and sensible for a human being to do? You know you're going to have to deal with something. So rather than pretend it doesn't exist, stick your head in the sand, why not just deal with it and get it over with? You know. So no one likes to admit in this material world that they're wrong. You know, no one likes to admit that there's somebody better. No one likes to admit that we make mistakes. But when we take up Krishna consciousness, this is like lesson number one. Okay, I used to think that I could be happy independently of God. Now I understand I need God. I need God to be happy. I need God to be sane. I need God to be whole. And therefore, I submit myself to his service. See? And I used to think that by serving my senses and mind, I'd be happy. And I've been doing that over and over, beating my head on the wall, beating this empty husk, finding nothing. And now I understand, no, when I try to make God happy, then I'll be happy. See? So this is called surrendering. Surrender means... there are six symptoms of surrender, or six expressions of surrender. The first one is to accept things which one may not like to accept. You know, getting up in the middle of the night, taking an icy cold shower. Well, or something like that. We're not so strict here in the Krishna house. Some ashrams are like that. Giving up, following the four regulative principles, meaning giving up so many kinds of sense gratification to which we may be accustomed. So this is voluntarily giving up something we don't want to give up. Then accepting something that we may not want to accept, like chanting japa. You know, the mind, when it comes to japa, the mind is saying, oh, you got to be kidding me. You know, I'm going to sit here for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, an hour, 2 hours. Right. The mind is totally put off by this because for the first time in our lives, we're challenging the tyranny of our minds and saying, no, I'm not just going to do whatever you tell me to do. You sit there and be quiet. I'm going to chant. And then the tussle begins. You know, so by practice, the mind eventually begins to say, all right, all right, all right. And then we make spiritual advancement. So that is not so easy in the beginning. It's not so palatable. It's not so pleasant. But it becomes very tasteful in time. So we voluntarily accept something we may not like to accept. Then the other things are very sweet. Thinking of Krishna as one's protector, thinking of Krishna as one's maintainer, having no interest separate from Krishna's interest, and expressing humility and feeling humble. You know, so these are nice things, easy things that follow the initial shock of sadhana and surrender. So you see, this is also a cultivation of knowledge, but it's a knowledge that's based on knowledge. It's based on real information. That we are tiny parts and parcels of God. And we are meant to be, we will be happy, we will be liberated when we're engaged in this service. Just that piece of information, that worldview, that perspective on life changes everything. Just contrast that with ordinary knowledge, which means when I get this knowledge, I'm really going to enjoy. Right? The arrogance of it and the falseness of it, the instability of it. That's why in academia, there is a nonstop competition to be the top dog. See, I was speaking with Rupa Chandra Prabhu about, and one of my friends wrote and said, I'm thinking of getting into academic study of Vaishnavism. So I referred him to Rupa Chandra Prabhu. And Rupa Chandra was saying that the problem, the difficulty about this particular field, there's pros and cons and everything, but the cons in studying Vaishnavism in college are that you cannot be too enthusiastic about any text. See, in the academic environment, if you are too enthusiastic about something, yeah, this is really true, or this, then they immediately say, oh, you're not objective, you're not a scholar. So he says, I have to choose my texts very carefully. So ones that I can critique, and not ones that I actually relish and get inspiration from. It's tough. But when we talk about knowledge, these are the limitations. It's based on arrogance, unless it is knowledge based on devotional service. Knowledge is concomitant to bhakti. Do you remember this verse from the first canto that we read a couple of weeks ago? Just last week, I think. Can anyone quote that verse? What happens when one begins serving Krishna? What two things appear? Knowledge and detachment, right. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita. Janayat Yasyu. Knowledge immediately comes. We get enlightenment from within the heart from Krishna. He gives us knowledge, causeless knowledge. Vairagya, detachment. Okay. We used to be so attached to this or that external thing in our lives, our appearance, our clothes, our hair, whatever, and we just become detached. The stuff is just not that important. So that's another feature of loving Krishna. When we actually love God, then we know things by Krishna's grace. We don't have to study them separately. So just one last reference here on the Gita. In the 18th chapter, Krishna talks about the three kinds of knowledge. Verse 21, knowledge according to the modes of nature. That knowledge by which one sees, I'm sorry, one back, it's verse 20. Yeah. That knowledge by which one's undivided spiritual nature is seen in all living entities, though they are divided into innumerable forms, you should understand to be in the mode of goodness. So this is knowledge in the mode of goodness. It's an impersonal knowledge, but at least it's based on spirituality, that there is a spirit soul in the heart of every living being, and including the animals and plants. That's Brahman realization. That knowledge is in the mode of goodness. And then that knowledge by which one sees that in every different body there is a different type of living entity, you should understand to be in the mode of passion. There's people I like, there's people I don't like. I like this gender, I don't like that gender. I like this nationality, don't like that one. This race, that age, etc., etc. So this is a mode of passion. And finally, that knowledge by which one is attached to one kind of work as the all in all, without knowledge of the truth, and which is very meager, is said to be in the mode of darkness. So this is the knowledge of the scholar on the boat. Right? He thinks it's such a big deal to know all these sciences, but in fact it's very meager. See? And without knowledge of the truth. So this is the mode of ignorance, which so much of ordinary academic knowledge can be categorized in this way. So, thank you. Any comments? Yes, please.
Going really well. They're having a really, really smooth life, you know. And you were talking about like miseries and how that brings people to.
Did you ever see the old television show Columbo? Anyone ever see that? Columbo is this detective. He's a real kind of grungy little man who was. He'd come on the crime scenes. He's always unshaven, and he looked like, you know, just like a real loser. And he would just kind of look around a little, and then he'd start to leave. And then he'd always say, oh, just have this one just one thing I wanted to ask you. He hears the guilty party, in other words, telling his story, and he accepts everything. He says, oh, I see. Okay, well, obviously you're not a suspect. And then he leaves. Oh, just one question. So you say like, okay, well, you're enjoying, you're having a good life. Good, okay. Oh, just one question. So ask a question like that will help them expand. And his questions were not antagonistic questions, just something like, I'm sorry, I'm a little slow, I can't figure this out. You're enjoying life now. How about in 40 years when you're physically no longer able to do what you're doing now, what will you do for happiness at that time? I see you're enjoying now. Very nice. What are you going to do in 40 years? So this is such a better approach than telling people, oh, you're not enjoying. They'll never agree. But rather ask questions that they ought to be asking but are too preoccupied to think of. Okay? Please.
I just want to comment. The person that is enjoying, that person also has to deal with disease and ultimately death. So even though it's the temporary happiness that he's enjoying, he still has to deal with reality. So that's all.
Right, so if this is great art, but if you can say it in such a way that they're not offended. Okay? Need my Pandit Prabhu? Yes. Yes, that knowledge is very important to cultivate. But the point is that it's based on a spiritual understanding. It's like people study Bhagavad Gita all over the world and don't have a clue about what it means. You know, as far as it doesn't impact their heart, their lives, their pursuit of sense gratification. Right? So yes, by all means, we cultivate knowledge. But this knowledge becomes very sweet and very relishable when we spiritual understanding. Kimani, you had a question.